it's as if I've hardly ever been away. It's only been 3 hours, thanks to Stuart Robertson for Drive on Suzy 103.4. Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay, and this is On the Front Foot. It may be the middle of the bleak midwinter, but Tim Bowling and I, Tim's the other side of the panel, hot foot from London, have decided that, well, there's plenty to talk about, and we've got a very special guest to talk about something very specific during our first hour. Introductions after just one track in a moment. That very special guest is Howard Cohen, and our old friend and pundit Jim Grant is going to be with us after 8 to talk through what's been going on, what's been going up, and what's been going down under this winter. This is On the Front Foot. Tim Bowling, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. And it's good to see you. And safely home through the rush hour?
Yes, just about. Unfortunately, I've got a suspected broken little toe that I managed to do last weekend. So it was a bit of a hobble to the station, but I'm okay.
But you didn't do it playing cricket?
No, sadly not. No, I didn't. I stubbed my toe on a wooden trunk. So there we go.
It's very easily done. It's great to have you here for this first show of the year. And without more ado, let's go to our first guest. We're very, very lucky to have Howard Cohen with us this evening. Howard, good evening.
Good evening, David.
It seems 5 minutes ago since you and I were watching the Grammar School play John Fisher, and there we were on the boundary discussing the prospects as adult cricketers for the Murtagh brothers.
That's absolutely right, and what good players both of them turned out to be. I think we spotted that pretty early on, and Tim's had a really wonderful professional career. He's had his benefit now, and of course he's playing international cricket as well with Ireland.
It's wonderful, isn't it, to think about that and back to those days. I mean, John Fisher must have been one of the biggest success stories in school cricket back in the 90s when Mike Davis decided to take it as seriously as they took the rugby, and they had some marvellous players.
I think that's right, and I'll tell you a small story about when I went for my interview to become the coach there. I was interviewed by a panel of three. Mike was sort of chairing it, very, very Welsh, as you know. And he said to me, now, if you get this job, he said, what are you actually going to do to raise the standards? So I said, well, you know, and I went through a whole list of things that I thought could be done to help. And he said, I see. He said, perhaps I ought to tell you that actually we only play cricket to fill in the gaps between the rugby seasons.
Oh, that's John Fisher all over. But Howard, you and I actually go back further than that. Rather than me giving you a great formal introduction, tell us what your current role is with the ACO and how, in fact, part of it is about to change.
Well, perhaps we ought to explain what the ACO is, first of all, because not everybody listening may be familiar with that.
OK, if you'd like to do that, go ahead.
ACO is shorthand, really, for the ECB Association of Cricket Officials. The ECB is the governing body for sport, for the whole sport in England and Wales, and the Association of Cricket Officials recruits, trains and appoints umpires and scorers for the whole game.
And you have a very significant role in that training setup.
I don't know how significant it is. I'm the regional education officer for London, which incorporates Essex, Kent, Middlesex and Surrey. And I'm also currently, although shortly to be relieved of the post, as education officer for Surrey itself.
I trust you're being relieved of the post of your own volition rather than any other reasons, deep and dark.
Yes, I think there's only so long you can do a job like that and retain the sort of enthusiasm that's necessary, because, you know, we're dealing with volunteers all the time. Everybody, it's a bit like this radio station, I suppose. It's a local organisation, and all those people who are involved in it are involved really for the betterment of the game. It's a game that they have a deep love for, but it is sometimes a little akin to herding cats, trying to get anything actually organised, because they're volunteers.
Do you know, that's the second time in a week I've heard that expression used. Completely different context. The other was former schoolmasters, but there we are, trying to organise a social event. Howard, tell us a little bit about how you came to cricket as a young man and what your club affiliations have been, and how your career path has been carved out with what is now the ACO.
Well, I had a really rather unusual entry into the whole thing. I played cricket at school. I was at school in Norfolk and played cricket there. And then when I left school, I was originally going to go onto university, and I was going to become a teacher. But things intervened and I didn't. And I went straight away out into the world of work, and I was working 6 days a week, and there really wasn't much opportunity for doing anything else other than collapsing on the seventh day. So I didn't get involved in playing cricket at all. And then in the late 60s, my parents moved to St. John's Wood, right next door to Lord's Cricket Ground. And what happened was, I had been working abroad, I came back, I was staying with my parents, and I went round the corner to the Lord's Tavern. And I didn't really understand the significance of it at all. I knew nothing about the history of cricket, really. But, you know, it's what it's like. You go into an English pub, if you go on a regular basis, you start off nodding to people who you recognise, and then eventually, after several months, you might actually say, do you fancy a drink, you know? And it turned out that the people that I was with were cricketers. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but they were. And most of them were on the Lord's ground staff. And then one day they said, we're playing cricket on Sunday, do you fancy coming along and watching? So I did, and one thing led to another. And I ended up meeting the head coach of MCC at that time, who was a wonderful gentleman called Len Munser. Len had played professional cricket before the Second World War. He'd played for Middlesex. He had a dreadful war. He was a prisoner of the Japanese and came back and somehow managed to play cricket again after the war. And he went to Glamorgan, where he became almost a saintly figure. He was part of the championship-winning side there after the war. And then when he retired, he was given this job at Lord's. Anyway, Len taught me pretty much everything I know about the technical side of cricket. He was just a wonderful person and a wonderful teacher, and I was very, very fortunate to know him. After a few years of going round with Len and watching the boys play and so on, I got a bit fed up with just watching cricket, and I was looking for something to do. Because of the level that I'd got involved, I didn't really fancy going and playing for a village fourth team, which is probably about the standard I would have been. So I thought, well, what can I do that perhaps I might have a chance of becoming quite good at? And somebody said, why don't you try umpiring? So I did. And I just went out and umpired. I had no training. And then I realised how dreadful I was at it from the players' reactions. And so I went and got some training. And in 1978, Middlesex formed the first panel of umpires in the south of England. There had been panels already established in the north, but there was nothing in the south of England. Middlesex bit the bullet, and they posted an advert in the magazine. That you'll remember getting a magazine called How's That? You remember that? And they were asking for full members of ACU who would be interested in joining this panel. I wrote in and said, I'm not a full member, but I have been to the training courses. And if you're short, you know, I'm available.
So let me stop you there for a second, Howard, because you mentioned the ACU. You've now got your foot on the ladder. Tell us a bit about the historical roots of the old association and how things have changed over the years.
Well, the ACU itself, and that stood for the Association of Cricket Umpires originally, and that was established in 1953 by an umpire called Tom Smith. And scorers weren't included in the title till several years later, and it became ACU&S. And the purpose was to provide training and advice to cricket officials. That's why it was originally established. And it was a completely amateur-run organisation, run entirely out of members' own funds through subscriptions. But their membership exceeded 8,000 and were spread in countries all over the world. And this lasted up until the time it was merged with ECB, and that was in the beginning of 2008. It also had taken upon itself the duty of assigning qualified umpires and scorers to cricket matches around the world. So it was training and appointment, really. It was the end of 2007 that the membership of ACU&S had voted against, actually it was 67-33 on a very low turnout, so not really a significant number of the total membership, to merge with the ECB Officials Association. So there was this merger, and it became the ECB Association of Cricket Officials. It now has 8,600 members, 1,000 of whom are scorers.
That's fascinating to hear. Of course, Tom Smith's name still applies, is still carried by what really is the seminal textbook for umpires, is it not?
That's right. The original cricket umpiring and scoring was written by a chap called Colonel Rate Carr, who was the secretary, I think, of MCC at the time. And it was later the editions were edited by Tom Smith himself. And then there were revisions. Every time the laws were revised, there was a revision of cricket umpiring and scoring. And it was some of it was done by Sheila Hill, who got the MBE, in fact, for her contribution to cricket, and was one of the first lady members of MCC when women were admitted for the first time. And later revisions, actually one of the leading lights in revising Tom Smith's later on was Graham Cooper, who you will know.
Yes, indeed.
And Graham would be very well known to anybody who's been involved in recreational cricket in Surrey, because, in fact, he was my predecessor as county education officer, and he held that post for 30 years. Mm. So he's made an enormous contribution to officiating in Surrey.
The last time I bumped into Graham was an ICC International T20 competition in Jersey, of all places.
Well, that's right, because Graham, in fact, went on. When he retired from his day job, he was employed by ICC Europe to recruit and train officials, and he travelled all over Europe doing this all the time and set up a remarkably good network of trained officials throughout Europe.
Tim, we're operating a bit of an old boys network over here. Two old friends leaving you out.
Oh, I'm fascinated just listening to it.
In the cold shoulder. But perhaps you'd like to take Howard on a bit now, because he's only just got his foot on the ladder.
Yes, well, you said that you'd... I think it was around about 1978 you'd reached, and you were telling us that you'd got on the ladder. How did things progress from there?
Well, this is a very good example of how much things have changed, and in fact for the better, to be honest. I got onto this league panel in 1978, and midway through the season I remember walking off the field after a league game at Bromsbury. And as normal, one turned round, shook hands with one's colleague, and this chap said to me, Howard, he said, would you be interested in doing county second 11 cricket? And I said, well, sort of interested, yes, but I don't have much experience. This is my first season of what you might call serious cricket. He said, don't worry about that, old chap. He said, I know what they're looking for. And as it happens, I do the appointments. So if you're interested, I'll get you a couple of games next season. So in 1979, I embarked on umpiring professional cricket.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. I mean, anybody listening to this would find it difficult to believe.
Was that a big jump from what you were used to? Presumably you were umpiring first 11 club cricket, and you'd stepped up to second 11 cricket county level. Was that a big leap?
It's a huge difference. Mm. It's a massive leap. First of all, you're doing multi-day games, which is a completely different situation from doing a game on a Saturday afternoon or even an all-day game on a Saturday. And secondly, the motivation of the people playing the game is so completely different. These guys are playing for a living, and many of them in second 11 cricket are playing for their contracts. Mm. So decisions that you make can have a really dramatic effect on a guy's career. Because at the end of the day, the cricket committee sit down and they decide who they're going to retain and who they're going to say goodbye to, and they look at the statistics. And, you know, if a chap's got to been given out when he shouldn't have been too many times, it will affect his statistics and his career. And it's a massive responsibility, really, when you think about it in those terms.
So you went from umpiring club games, where you were generally umpiring at weekends, to umpiring during the week, pretty much full-time, I assume. How many seasons did you continue to umpire second 11 cricket for?
17. That's 1-7 for anybody who thought I might have said 70.
Wow, 17. So yes, that was. It certainly became a full time profession for you then, almost in the summer.
Well, to give you an idea, the current first class umpires, the people doing county cricket, the stuff you see on the television, they do about 90 days a year. And in my pomp, as I call it, I was doing over 100.
Howard, we could go on talking the history of the association and the meteoric rise of Howard Cohen all night, but let's cut to the chase, because I told you, time is always limited on this show. What's the ACO up to now at its various levels, and in particular, what does your role as an education officer involve?
Well, on the off chance that anybody's still awake after listening to the first part of our discussion, the ACO has a challenge, and that is to try to satisfy the requirements of the players. It's as simple as that. The ECB carried out one of the biggest surveys ever carried out by any sports governing bodies, and discovered that this may seem a bit strange, but the players actually think that it's a better game when there are official umpires standing than when they have to go out there and umpire the game themselves. Surprise, surprise. But anyway, everybody at the ECB has been jumping up and down and filled with excitement and enthusiasm, and we are tasked with going out and recruiting as many officials as we possibly can, giving them the very best training that we possibly can, and trying to satisfy the needs of the game. The problem is, however, that officials actually are not much different from the players, and in the same way that the players show perhaps less commitment than they used to do many years ago. They certainly are time poorer than we were when we were younger. There are very few players, for example, who play 2 days at the weekend as we were brought up doing. The same thing applies to officials. We're recruiting more and more officials, but they're actually umpiring fewer and fewer games. And that's just because of the pressures of life and the demands of other halves and so on and so forth. Actually, I blame property prices for all of this, because they've become so exorbitant. You can't possibly pay a mortgage off on a single salary, not the average chap can anyway. And so both parties are now out at work, which wasn't always the case when I was growing up. And so there's just more pressure and less ability to engage in cricket.
I think one of the things we've noted from doing these shows when we've had guests come in is the amount of, you're quite right, the lack of time that people generally have. And it's amazing how many clubs, my own club is included, who amount of teams within clubs that they can actually put out, because people aren't prepared to actually as you say, play even a whole day in the weekend, let alone 2 days, which is why I guess T20 cricket in the short form is becoming at local level more popular, because it can be played of an evening. But you're quite right, and it's as you say, it's the same for umpires, for scorers and for players, that people just will not commit to the amount of time that they would do even when I was a kid.
On the upside, however, we have got much better opportunities for training people professionally. It used to be a real chalk and talk business, learning to umpire. You had a single bloke standing at the front talking away. There were no visuals of any sort. If it was considered pretty advanced when I was trained that the chap had a flip chart. But now, of course, we've got the most wonderful technological assistance to help us with our training, and we've got wonderful video clips of incidents, so we don't need to talk anything like as much as we used to. We can actually show. We can say, here's the principle, now have a look at these and tell us what you think. So there's a much more interactive approach to it. There's a lot of stuff which is now available online. The MCC have produced the most wonderful resource on the laws of cricket that anybody can log on to and register on and go through the laws in their own time. They don't have to any longer go out to some drafty pavilion in the middle of winter for weeks on end through the wind and the rain and sit there in a draft and you know, I mean, it is just so much better now.
Howard, can I come in there? Because obviously we have a current revision of the laws about to go into full flow. Without wanting to put you on the spot, do you think there are any specifics in that revision of the laws which are going to be really important for umpires and players, not necessarily in the premierships, but at local level?
Well, just before I answer that question directly, let me say that we're putting on 3 special evenings to explain the new laws of cricket. One is at the Oval on the 27th of February. There's a presentation at the Harlequin Theatre in Redhill, very close to here, following that, and then there's one at Farnham also. And anybody, you don't have to be a member of ECBACO, anybody with an interest in cricket is very welcome to go onto our website. There are links there. You just click through and register.
What's the website address? Have you got it there?
The website address is www.surreycricketofficials.org.uk.
Howard, about the new laws then, is there anything that stands out to you as an umpire and a trainer of very long experience?
There are a couple of things which I think are going to have a significant impact. One is there's a new concept of penalty time which has never existed before. Previously, if somebody was, say from the fielding side, if somebody was off the field for more than 15 minutes, then they had to be back on the field for the equivalent amount of time that they had been off it before they could bowl. This whole concept has now been expanded. Everybody starts off with 0 penalty time at the beginning of the game, but every moment that they're off the field counts against them, and it does prevent. So a chap, for example, who might have bowled the first over previously, realised he'd put the wrong boots on, rushed off and changed his boots and came on and then bowled the next over at the same end, he can't do that any longer. There will be a penalty. And this whole business of penalty time is going to actually be quite complicated for umpires to keep a track of. And so that's one thing that I think people are going to need quite a bit of training and practice at. The other thing, which is the really big hot issue, is player behaviour. Quite a significant number of the umpires that we've trained, and I'm speaking now about the whole country, quite a number of them have had a go at umpiring and not actually enjoyed the experience very much because of really poor behaviour by players. Fortunately, it's not as widespread as it is, say, for example, in football. I mean, why anybody ever goes out and umpires a game of kids' football on a Sunday morning I will never understand, largely because the parents are so badly behaved.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this has now spread into cricket. And there are really quite severe penalties that the umpires will be able to impose. And this is for the first time previously in cricket, almost unique in sport. The on-field umpires couldn't really take any action at all. All they could do was report what had happened after the game. And then it was up to an independent disciplinary committee to decide what they thought a suitable penalty would be. Now, the umpires can take action themselves. It's been hailed as yellow and red cards in the press, but we're not going to be brandishing either colour card. But we can actually take direct action in certain circumstances. And those circumstances are prescribed. Offences have been divided up into four different levels. And with a level three or four offence, the player will actually have to leave the field.
Yeah, I think this has been such a vexed question for so long. My impression, I mean, it's been a couple of years now since I've done any school first 11 cricket, but my impression was that behaviour in schools cricket had improved again by, let's say, 2013-14 compared with 10 years previously. But one does hear, I mean, I've not been involved in the club game in any way at all, really, for a very long time, but you do hear horror stories. I watch a little bit of Sussex Championship Division 3 in the summer, and you see a few toe-curling incidents there, and I fear that it does come from footballing attitudes to referees.
I think it comes from major changes in social attitudes, to be honest. I mean, when you and I were growing up, David, we were brought up to be fairly deferential to authority. It wasn't that long after the end of the Second World War, after all, and quite a lot of the people who were in charge of us, including many of our teachers, had been in these services. And they came back, and there was a great deal of discipline. There was a huge emphasis on discipline. Now I think things have changed, and people are much more questioning of authority, much less likely just to toe the line because you say do this. They're going to say why. I think our generation probably were much more reticent in that regard.
And I suppose as well, playing as I did mainly Sunday wandering cricket because I was busy with school on a Saturday, but even across the board in the times that we're talking about now, league points were not at stake, positions were not at stake, and this term that we hear bandied about all the time in cricket now, everything must have context.
Yes, and part of the context, I'm afraid, goes back to the origins of the ECB Premier Leagues. When it was being discussed as to whether Premier Leagues should be introduced, I can remember at that time I was heavily involved at Cheam Cricket Club, and I was actually the only dissenting voice when it was shall we vote to go in the Premier League or not? And I did explain at the time that it would change the face of cricket. And what's happened as a result of all of this is that firstly, players have a much less degree of loyalty to their own clubs. There's much more movement around the county from club to club. And horror of horrors, as far as I'm concerned, people are actually being paid to play recreational cricket. To me, this is an anathema. I just don't understand why anybody would want to pay somebody £300 or £400 to play a game of cricket on a Saturday. I just don't get it.
Tim, I think it's fair to say, no names, no pack drill, clearly, but you have to be quite exceptional as, let's say, a 15-year-old now to have any sort of an assured path into the first team at one of the biggest clubs, whether around here or
elsewhere. Yeah, I think so.
Elsewhere.
I mean, you're right. Occasionally, a youngster will come through who is genuinely talented, and they're the guys that tend to move fairly quickly through first 11 cricket into second 11 county cricket and so on and so forth. But Howard, you're quite right. I mean, I see it in cricket, you know, in the club cricket, you see professionals coming over every summer. Every club has an overseas professional now. If they want to be at the top flight, they're paying other players to pay to play for them. And it is a thin end of a wedge, and it's a sad sort of development in the whole of cricket.
It was always one of the biggest disappointments at Cheam. I mean, Cheam has one of the finest wickets in the whole county, and it has done for a very long time. It's pacey, it's bouncy, it's fair to both sides, and people love playing there. But it costs an absolute fortune to maintain it like that, and it was always something that irked our players that they would, so much of the club's money was spent on preserving the quality of the pitches, and then they would go and play their away games at clubs who were paying overseas players and also local players quite a lot of money, and not spending that money on the quality of the pitches.
I think with the overseas players is that the clubs generally hope that the overseas player will come over, play it, and obviously help push the club up the league, but also will help with training and coaching and that sort of stuff. Unfortunately, with some of them, that doesn't necessarily happen. It doesn't pan out as perhaps the club had first hoped. Lots of them do it. Lots of them do help with the coaching, which is to the benefit of the club. But it, as you say, when you start paying local people to play as well, it sets quite a precedent, really, for what's going to happen in the future.
Well, there was a time when all the leagues in the south of England were amateur, including the Surrey Championship, which is the top league in Surrey. But the Surrey Championship had to face reality. It was obvious that people were being paid, and so they said, look, we can't hold back the tide, we will go open. And the Surrey Championship was one of the first leagues in the south of England to acknowledge the fact that people were being paid to play. But I think it's had a detrimental effect.
Do you think that in terms of how players react to umpiring decisions has gone rapidly downhill since players were paid?
I think it does have an impact, especially those players that are on an incentive form of payment. They're going to, you know, they're never out. It doesn't matter what happens, they're never out. And it always makes me laugh, some of the expressions that players use. I missed it by a mile. He knocked the cover off it. I often say to players, I'm sure if either of those were true, I might have noticed.
Yeah. I think also what happens these days as well is that players are less likely to, for example, walk when they've nicked one or whatever. And I think that doesn't help the whole situation as far as the umpires are concerned. When there's difficult decisions to be made, we're all human. Often you don't hear a faint edge, but a batsman will always know when he's nicked it. I mean, I say that maybe as a wicketkeeper, I'm slightly biased, but even when I'm batting, if I nick it, I know I've nicked it, even if it's the faintest of edges. And I think it's bad when players don't walk and don't actually play the game properly, because it makes the umpire's job that much more difficult.
Well, of course, that supposes that there ever was a golden age where everybody walked. Mm. I think myself that probably what happened was people walked when it didn't matter terribly they were out or not, and probably developed reputations as walkers, and consequently if they nicked one at a particularly critical time, maybe they stood there and nobody said anything because they had a reputation of being walkers.
Yep. Howard, we're short of time. Let me ask you how you see, and again, I'm not really thinking about premierships, how you see the health of umpiring in club cricket, recreational cricket. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Burgess Hill, Sussex Division 3 that I watch sometimes, Merstham over the road at the bottom tier now of the Surrey Championship. How healthy do you think umpiring is? And do you think, as I suspect there may maybe, there are all sorts of elephant traps lying in wait nowadays for poor old 9, 10 and Jack, who still have to put the white coat on and go out and umpire?
I think that is really difficult. I think it's an unreasonable position to put players in, because, you know, are they expected to give the members of their own side out? I think it's a very big ask. What I would say is, though, that we're doing everything we possibly can to help them. There's a specific training video, for example, available on our national website, which is for players who go out and do, say, 10 overs on a Saturday or a Sunday, to help them, to give them the basic ideas as to what it is they ought to be looking for. It's an interesting thing, you know, when we get people coming along to be trained as umpires, they say, oh, I've played for 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is, I know all. And I can't remember a single training session where one of these chaps hasn't at some point turned around and said, God, I played all those years and I never realised that.
Mm. Mm. Howard, in the interests of balance and also time running short, you and I go back to the days of John and Kitty Merritt when a lady umpire was a relatively unusual occurrence. But I'm right in saying, am I not, that quite apart from the scoring side of things, the ACO now encompasses a wide variety of lady officials. You mentioned Sheila Hill earlier.
Yes, you're right, David. I think one of the best things that's happened in my time in cricket is the growth of women's cricket. I just think it's marvellous, and I've been fortunate enough to umpire quite a bit of women and girls cricket, and I've watched it develop from something pretty inadequate to something highly competitive, and England winning the World Cup, of course, will be an inspiration to women and girls throughout the country. Funnily enough, I spoke to somebody from the Surrey Cricket Foundation only on Monday night, saying, why is it we're not getting more women coming through to be trained as umpires? We would welcome the opportunity. We want more women umpiring. Women and girls cricket could do with having women umpiring it, and there is no reason whatsoever why women can't umpire men's cricket.
Well, I have in front of me the article about Claire Polosak, who umpired the England warm-up 50-over game prior to the ODI series down under. And it says she's already broken ground by becoming the first woman to umpire in a men's one-day game, standing in a match between New South Wales and a Cricket Australia 11 in October. And she's only 29 years old. She's never played the game.
Well, that says absolutely everything, doesn't it? You don't have to have played the game to become an umpire. You have to love the game. And that's the most important thing. If you love the game, if you're open-minded, if you're willing to learn, if you want to be involved in the game and make things better, do come along and let us train you.
So I suppose at this point we should ask you again what the initial recourse is for anyone who might be listening tonight, hasn't thought about being involved before, but might now be inspired by our combined dulcet tones to do so.
All the information that anybody could possibly want is available on our website, www.surreycricketofficials.org. .uk.
Howard, there are so many surfaces that we haven't even scratched this evening. We've got a couple of minutes before we go through the news at the top, and then my colleague Jim Grant is going to join us and we're going to talk about events down under in the winter. A couple of minutes reflections from you on the Ashes?
Well, I was fortunate enough to actually go to Australia for the first time this winter. I had never previously ventured that far, but circumstances arose that enabled that to happen, and I went and saw the last two test matches. That is, the one at Melbourne and the one at Sydney. And one thing I can say for certain, there was no lack of effort by any England player. And if they got beaten, which they did, they were beaten by a better side. And I just don't think we can ask any more than for our players to give everything. And I assure you, they certainly did.
That's really good to hear. We've got about a minute. What was the experience like at the MCG and the SCG?
Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. It was great. I mean, the banter with the crowd and the players and the Barmy Army, of course, and their wonderful songs. You know, England 3-0 down in a five-match series, and there's the Barmy Army singing, "We're going to win 4-3. I mean, it was just absolutely priceless.
And, I mean, I've never been that distance. Is the travelling as tough as some people say it is to get there?
Not really. Not if you travel like I did. I have to say, I slept most of the way. It was wonderful.
I'm sure that's the way to do it. And England prospects going forward?
Well, I think we'll be good at home. I think we'll be very competitive at home. What we haven't really been able to develop is the ability to play away. Conditions are that much different, and I don't think that the format of the county championship helps to develop the sort of players that we're going to need to win cricket matches overseas.
I'm sure that is the case. We may get on to talking a bit about the championship tonight, no doubt later in the season. And speaking of later in the season, Howard, if you and we have a window, would you come back? Because there's so much we haven't talked about tonight.
Well, I'm humbled by your invitation, and of course, how could I refuse?
Well, we've thoroughly enjoyed having you. The hour has flown by. Howard Cohen, I'll just call you County Education Officer with the Surrey Association of Cricket Officials for this evening. It's been an absolute delight talking to you here on the front foot, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the second and final hour of this bleak midwinter on the front foot on Susie 103.4. We've had a fascinating hour talking with Howard Cohen about all things umpiring. We're going to have one track, a very appropriate track too, for Botham's Ashes. And then we'll be introducing our next pundit to you, Jim Grant. And in this hour, we're going to be ruminating on what's gone well and what hasn't down under in what seems an increasingly long winter. It's Tim Bowling and David Jay here on the front foot. Jim Grant, good evening and welcome back.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's lovely to have you here, and we've got an hour to dissect a summer down under of ups and downs, I suppose, is the best way of looking at it. And what with the World Cup for the under-19s and the tri-series that's just happened and the series in New Zealand that's about to start, it seems to me that it is rather going on forever. But, Jim, do you think we actually learned anything from the Test series other than the old Ashes adage that ultimately the side with the best fast bowlers wins the series?
Well, that was certainly the case. I think we didn't learn that much about the England team that we didn't really sort of anticipate was going to be the case. We knew we were going out short of top order batting, and a lot would depend on Cook finding form. And in many ways, if the 240 odd had been spread across several innings, rather than the one magnificent one, that might have helped. Once Stokes was out, we knew that we were going to be short of firepower on the seam bowling front, and also a crucial element of what has been very good late middle order batting in recent times. Moeen unfortunately had a bit of a mare.
Yeah, I think it was the perfect storm of everything going wrong, wasn't it, in the actual Test series. I think you're quite right with Cook's that amazing innings. I think he was one of the first batsmen, or one of the few batsmen, should I say, that scored a double hundred in a Test series and then didn't manage to reach 50 in any particular innings. And it's interesting, actually, because I think Joe Root and Alastair Cook's across the Test series managed to score roughly the same amount of runs, whereas Root's were spread across, albeit he didn't get a 100 himself, but he got several 50s. It was spread across there. And the fact that neither of those two fired meant that when we had that slightly weaker 3, 4 and 5, let's say, or 4, 5 and 6, whatever, it just all added together to make everything seem to go wrong.
Yes, I mean that what you say about Root, though, it time and again he is becoming the 60-70 man, isn't he? And you know, the big difference was that Smith especially, but also Marsh when he came in, they were getting hundreds and we were getting 50s 40s 60s. In fact, in the first Test, won the toss and batted, lots of people got a start. And we were doing all right. We were 127 I think for one, we were 240 odd for four. We should have built, I think we were all about 300 all out in the end, weren't we? We should have built a bigger platform. I think, and but and it was silly, you know, the silly run out of Vince. There were silly wickets given away, weren't they? Loose shots.
I know it's an obvious thing to say. Do you think part of the problem is, and it's something I guess we've touched on before, do you think part of the problem is the fact that county cricket just doesn't prepare you enough for an overseas Ashes tour against hostile bowlers in sometimes hostile grounds?
I think that's true, but I think that's probably always, to a certain extent, been the case. And, you know, it is a tough... It's always been, historically, a tough place to go and win a series. You know, as is the Asian subcontinent. You know, this is not a new phenomenon. Mm. But I just think, you know... A point I'd like to explore, really, is how well, in comparison, we did in the 50-over... games.
Yes. Yeah.
And the fact that the personnel was so different. Mm. And I'm intrigued. I don't know what you chaps think about this, but I wonder whether there's a degree to which the 50 over side is being prioritised.
Yes. Yeah.
On the back of the thought that obviously that they feel they've got a real shout at the next World Cup.
Mm. Well, Strauss pretty much said as much, didn't he? And the intention in engaging Bayliss, I think, was to improve the one-day international cricket, which, strangely enough, seems to be the format of the three that's arguably most under threat. But let's come on to that in the second half of the show. Yes, Jim, I'm sure you're right. And are you a fan of the... Atherton has come out and said, let's have one squad for all three formats, whereas other pundits are saying, no, it must be clearly divided, and if necessary, separate coaches. What do you think?
I don't know about separate coaches. I think there are some people who are making themselves into specialists, and that's more true of 20 over cricket than 50, I would argue. I feel, I mean, you know, when Roy came in and got that 180-odd, and you think of all the struggles we had at the top order, I'm thinking, well, if he can smack Stark all around the ground with a wide ball, you know, why couldn't he have opened the batting in the Test series? It seems a bit odd to me. And the other one I would pick out, the obvious one to pick out, is Adil Rashid. Because there we are with you know, an obvious lack of spin bowling. I mean, that we obviously lost out in the fast bowling stakes, but we were also out bowled by Lyon out bowling Ali to such a great extent was interesting.
Let's explore that thread for a moment then, because this week Rashid has come out and told Yorkshire where to put their red ball cricket. He's not going to play in the championship any longer.
Same as Alex Hales.
And Hales has now followed suit. Morgan, funnily enough, having set the trend, is now saying that he wants to play some Red Bull Championship cricket for Middlesex to hone his technique. And the other fly in the ointment is Joss Butler, who clearly can make a career out of short form white ball, coloured ball cricket. But going on the record, I think while he was captaining England in Morgan's absence through injury, and saying that soon there will only be T20. It's a bit of a can of worms, isn't it?
It is. Oh, it is, absolutely. That has been my fear for some time. I think last time I was on, we probably ended up talking about the fact that, you know, the way it's heading, the game worldwide, you can see it being a kind of T20 circuit of professional leagues, with players almost like golfers going on the tour and, you know, being like mercenaries hawking their skills around, and international cricket sort of falling in the spaces. And
I suppose to an extent you've got to take into account that Rashid and Alex Hales are no longer in the first flush, nor are they certain of a test place anytime soon. So from a financial security point of view and so on, I do just have the impression, and it's very difficult, I mean, in my former life and your still current one, Jim, you become a bit of a people watcher. And I'm not sure, watching from a great distance, halfway across the world and on a TV screen, perhaps just how happy campers either Rashid and Hales are in the whole setup. I get a bit of body language, particularly in the field, and you just wonder whether, and not apropos the Stokes incident with Hales, but various things that have gone on with Rashid at Yorkshire. You just wonder whether they might be quite difficult individuals to handle.
Well, they might be, but I mean, there have been plenty of those down the years as well. I mean, I don't imagine Mr. Botham was particularly easy to captain and handle. That's the job of a management team and a captain, isn't it, to get Mavericks playing well.
And yeah, it's interesting. We were talking with Howard Cohen in the first hour about he and I, you to a certain extent, having grown up in an age of deference to captains and managers and umpires, which is perhaps no longer the case. But I suppose with rights go responsibilities. I know it's a cliche, but did anybody really need to be at a Bristol nightclub at 2 o'clock in the morning?
That's the whole ridiculous nature of the particular tour, when they could easily have been told, you're in a hotel, there's presumably a hotel bar there, you can have one drink, stay in the hotel bar. So then instead of that, they all go to different nightclubs. Having had one incident, they then regroup back at the same nightclub a few days later, and they can't understand why the press are there or why people have got their mobile phones out. And once again, people are pouring drinks over each other's heads and so on and so forth. Yep.
And you just knew the Aussie press are going to look for any opportunity once they were out
in the middle of a very unsuccessful Ashes tour. You know, if I'm not condoning it, but if we were in the situation where we were absolutely romping home in every test, then perhaps there might be slightly more leniency from the press. You know, in the days of Botham and Dennis Lilly and all these guys, they would go out on the night of the rest day and all this sort of stuff, and they would have a drink and it was fine. But you can't do it anymore.
Well,
they didn't have mobile phones.
No, that's it. I was just going to say that. You know, they live in an age of CCTV and everybody's got their own video camera.
But why do these professional players not learn? They must have agents of their own who are saying to them, right, don't do this. You've got image rights to think about. You've got all this other stuff to think about. They just do not learn. That England team did not learn. And that was the problem. They just didn't learn from their mistakes off the field or on the field.
Human beings, I suppose, feet of clay. And I would guess that it's a very long time since I was a young man, but I would guess that fame is very seductive and perhaps gives you, after all, you've both heard me say this in different contexts, but in an age, you mentioned social media and mobile devices, everybody down to the last pebble on Brighton Beach thinks that they are the star performer in a drama with an enormous audience. And if you've got a real audience sitting 20,000, 60,000, 100,000 at the MCG round watching you play cricket, it must be very empowering, to use another word.
But I think Jim's right what he said earlier on. It's the job of the management team and the job of Andrew Strauss and whoever he decides to actually put in place. And in the old days, there would have been an old-fashioned tour manager who was purely there to try and corral the players. And they don't seem to have that anymore. There seems to just be a free rein for these players to do what they want, which has created these problems that have manifested themselves into England getting absolutely destroyed by the Aussies.
Shall we get back to the Ashes itself rather than the peripheral issues? But we've talked about Adil Rashid, and why, hindsight's a wonderful thing, why pick Mason Crane in the Ashes squad ahead of the most successful leg spin bowler that we've had arguably since Doug Wright?
Yeah, no, baffling, absolutely baffling. And you know, the fact that he really did so well in the 50 over games just, you know, reinforces that view. I mean, he was leading wicket taker. His economy rate was good. His average wasn't bad. He took 10 wickets at about 30, I think, in that series. So I can't imagine there's that such a difference between the formats of, you know, it's still bowling a ball at people, isn't it? It made no sense to me.
I think there was an article, I can't remember whether it was written by Derek Pringle or another player, it might have been Pringle anyway, and the argument was in the article that the reason that Rashid does so well at white ball cricket is because in white ball cricket, batsmen have to go after him. In Test cricket, they won't necessarily have to go after him. But that's the same for any leg spinner.
Well,
so if you're going to pick Mason Crane, you might just as well pick Rashid.
And
also, his batting is, I think, he's
a decent all-rounder. Yeah, he can bat a bit.
You know,
yeah.
They talk about Moeen Ali being an all-rounder. Moeen Ali's a good batsman who bowls a bit, whereas Rashid is, I think, could actually become a very good batsman.
And in your one-day team, they both play, and Rashid's your wicket taker, and Ali is your keep it tight merchant. Yeah. And so, again, that seems counterintuitive in terms of what, you know, which one you'd pick for your test team. Mm. And they, yeah, as you say, they're both bad.
You're right, Jim. Ali was very much exposed as a test player in Australian conditions. Not the first, mind you, and off-spinners in Australia traditionally haven't done so very well, although Nathan Lyons seemed to clean up when he wanted to.
Mm. I felt Stokes' absence is the piece of the Jenga pile that was pulled out, and it all came down. I mean, I think that put enormous pressure on him and Wokes to score runs late order, and not to have someone who's just going to bash it the other end, and I think that's Bairstow as well to an extent. I would argue, so they were under pressure to get runs. And we weren't fighting fire with the bowling. And of course, you know, Plunkett played in the one days, didn't he? And he bowls 90 mile an hour at times. And I suppose Wood was probably not deemed fit enough for them to risk in a test, I guess. But we could have done with those guys, couldn't we, in the tests?
Plunkett's fallen into that sort of area where he's deemed again to be a white ball specialist. And again, when you look at you're quite right, the pace that he brings when he's bowling, and the fact that he can bat as well, I do not understand why he isn't picked. As you say, he's a good player, but again, we seem to have this mindset of, well, he's a white ball player, he's a red ball player.
Increasingly.
The white ball players are clearly performing and the red ball players aren't. So why are we not just saying, well, these guys are no good, let's try these other guys? Yeah. I just have one squad. I don't understand why that wouldn't be something they would try out.
Well, Tim, you were an advocate of Liam Plunkett for the Ashes side before it was even picked, and I've some sympathy with that. Best fast bowlers, I mean, whether you go back to Gregory and McDonald or Limbaugh and Miller or Truman and so whoever, the side with the best fast bowlers is a long way. We've dealt a little bit with the leg spin side of things. I was interested, Jim, we kind of drifted away from it, but you were talking right at the top about transferable skills, and if Roy can do that in a 50 over match, why not let him open in a test match, because he's not going to do any worse. It might be a bit hit and miss, but I remember a mutual friend of ours saying to me in the 1980s, well, at different scoring rates in those days, obviously, if you've got somebody who can get you 30 in the first half hour, David, you're off and running. I mean, now it's probably 70 in the first half hour, but the principle applies, doesn't it?
No, I had a conversation, I remember having a conversation with him about very much about this thing in top level cricket, that there are these guys scoring 5-6 and over and thinking nothing of it. He was arguing that it was baffling that they wouldn't just go and do the same in a test match. And of course, a few years later, the Australian test team proved him right. You can score at 4 and 5 and over in test cricket.
And of course, currently you've also got Australia not picking Glenn Maxwell for the Red Bull, which baffles me. But I suppose they're aiming for consistency. They don't want hit and miss. They don't want to allow genius to be wayward, maybe. Mm. But anyway, it was all a bit one-sided. David Milan came out of it all pretty well.
Yes, I think so. I agree. How old is he? I mean, is he...
He's 30 now.
He's 30 now.
He's 30 years old. I was reading an article earlier on that was suggesting that he could actually... temporarily become England captain if Root was injured, because he's just been made Middlesex club captain, and the suggestion was that he's capable of stepping up to the England side as captain if Root were to be injured. So
interestingly, David Milan forced himself in via the T20, that marvellous 70 that he made in absolutely no, was it at Bristol? I can't remember, but that was how he established himself. And we were sitting here talking back in the autumn before they set off down under, and we were talking about Cook and Root against Smith and Warner, and in the end it was really no contest.
Yeah, I mean, Steve Smith was absolutely phenomenal, wasn't he?
He is emerging as a bit of a phenomenon. I mean only Bradman and Gavaskar, I think, faster to 2300s.
Yeah, what a difference
an extraordinary conversion rate from 50s to 100s, and there is a really stark divergence with Root, isn't there? You know, Root gets to 50 a lot.
Gentlemen, I need to take a break. Let's come back to Steve Smith specifically after the break. I'm only going to play one song here because it occurred to me that when we were in Priory Park for the Christmas Outside broadcast, I managed to catch up for 2 or 3 minutes with Pat Pocock.
Yeah, it's 208 for four overnight after rain, I think. What do you reckon, Pat? What do you make of what's going on out
well,
there?
It was... we've got some unproven players at the moment, but like in many other tours, they've gone away as unproven and unknown, and suddenly they've got stuck in and they've done well and they've grown and they've materialised on tour, and they come back quite a proficient side.
You, of course, have been involved in a lot of sports broadcasting, public speaking, all of those things. I was talking to you just now off air about your son Toby, because of course you and I go back a long way with my former profession, and your son Toby was involved in my former profession up the road at the grammar school, and I really did smile. I was a couple of years back, I did a sort of charity 20 over game down the road at the grammar school's ground, and Toby turned up with his drone with the video camera. I was absolutely amazed out there in the middle with this helicopter flying around. It's amazing how technology's moved forward, isn't it?
Yeah, he does it very well. I'm slightly biased, as you can imagine, but I can't be that biased because he is number one on Google, so it means to say that he does a lot of it right, yeah. No, it's I've only been here for 48 years in Reigate, which is when you were just a little boy.
Just the 48, yeah.
Just the 48 years.
I did 36 up the road, and I've been doing this now for six. You got any predictions about the way the Ash is going to turn out?
Well, obviously we're going to have to turn things around. When you start off the way that we have, you can't do any worse than losing by almost an inning. So we've got a long way to go. But for many of them, they haven't played any Test matches before. So it's a question of getting used to the conditions and making their own ability fit the conditions.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're here. I must just ask you to tell us about the world record that you still hold, the 7 wickets.
Blimey.
Go on.
Well, we were playing at Sussex and we were losing the game. They were, I think, about 190 for one, chasing 217. And then I got 7 wickets in 11 balls, which sounds pretty good. Obviously, the figures are good, but no one played and missed. If they played and missed, they nicked it. If they missed it, it either hit the stumps or hit them on the pad, and they were out LBW. Any time the batsman hit the ball in the air, someone was underneath it to catch it. So you could say that everything just went my way. You know, if you think I worked in golf for a long time after I packed up playing, and you think you play over a 72 hole event, and how many of those times do you lip out off the edge of the cup? You might do it three or four times, and it makes a difference of you winning or not winning, or coming 8th or 10th or something like that. Or how many times have you ever seen a batsman score 100 runs without playing or missing at least half a dozen times? Or just those once he gets a bit closer to it, he nicks it and he's out. So obviously it was a good performance, but everything has to go exactly right for you to come in with any scores or figures.
Reigate resident Pat Pocock of Surrey in England speaking to me in the Outside Broadcast Unit back in December at Reigate on Ice. You're with Susie 103.4. Jim Grant, Tim Bowling with me here in the studio. Gentlemen, we can go various ways here. We need certainly to talk about the two captains in the Ashes. Let's just go to the fast bowlers because that's where we started. So we've come round full circle. And Tim, you were just making the point that Stark 22 wickets, Cummins 23, Josh Hazlewood 21. They really were shared around.
Yeah, they were fantastic unit, you have to say. And it is, you know, I mean, we could talk about how, you know, Australian batsmen went on to get hundreds and England batsmen timed in, got a start and then gave it away, and you know, Boycott is always very kind of dismissive about this and the loose shots they play, but it is when you've got repeat, you know, you've got consistent 90 mile an hour plus bowling coming at you, it's relentless. There's no break from it.
It was like the old West Indies side, wasn't it, of the 70s
exactly.
and 80s, where one came off and you think, oh, in a normal side, one would come off, you think, oh, he's gone now.
Yeah.
When the next one comes on, you're getting exactly the same, you know, pitched at your throat. It just is relentless. Yes.
And in your head, Hazelwood's a sort of fast medium.
Glenn McGrath.
But actually, he's fast, isn't he? He's
great. According to this table of statistics, they all three of them touch 95 mile an hour bowling in test matches. So, best fast bowlers win the game. I suppose the difference with the 80s, Tim, is that West Indies didn't bother about Nathan Lyon or anybody else who was a spin bowler.
They only bowled 11 overs an hour some of the time.
So. Yeah. Short-changing the spectators. But let's not go there. Let's talk about the two captains, because looking at things at the end, given the heat in Sydney, Joe Root was totally physically shot. I mean, they said he had gastroenteritis, but my guess is it was pure dehydration and stress, and he was completely shot. But if you look at Smith in the One Day International series, he wasn't far behind being shot. They'd given their all, and I think, you know, we talk about conversion rates and all of these things. You would have said before the series started, I'm going to score 378 runs at 47.25. That'll do me in an Ashes series down under. And that's what Root achieved, in spite of us sitting here saying, well, he didn't really do terribly well.
I think those stats are good, and it's context, isn't it? It's the fact that he gets in and he's doing well, and it's the points at which he gets out in games, and it's the fact that he was a lone hand a lot of the time. I mean, there was Malan's 100 and obviously the massive Cook innings, but apart from that, at best they got 100, didn't he, at one point with Malan. But apart from that, you're looking at sort of scores that are okay, but don't put you in a commanding position in a test match.
Graham Gooch, he used to describe it as big hundreds, didn't he? You need to score a big hundred. Yeah. Well, Root didn't even score 100, and that was the difference. When you look at the stats of how it sort of played out, Stephen Smith was ahead of, I think in aggregate runs, was ahead by about 300 runs or something. I think it was something in terms of how much Root had scored. So that's the difference. You've got a player there at the top of the order who is putting away big amounts of runs, then you're always going to set yourself up for a chance of winning.
6.87 at a mere 137.4. Right. I mean, that's staggering in any age by any analysis. Those are staggering figures. And highest score 239. I mean, there's not a 300 and some odd in there to bolster it. But looking down the list, five Australian batsmen made hundreds, and one of those was 103. But the next lowest was 156 highest score. So hundreds, as you say, a la Graham Gooch. So what about this chap Smith? We were talking off air, Jim, and you alluded to that, to a couple of Bradman-esque elements, not yet Bradman.
Yes, I mean, I saw some sort of television analysis of his play, and to me he's always looked a sort of slightly ungainly, slightly ugly batsman at the crease in a way, but at the point where he plays the ball, he's actually very orthodox. His head's right over it, and he's very correct. But he picks the bat up towards gully. It's quite a wide pickup, and of course that is how Bradman used to pick the ball, although I never saw Bradman in the flesh, obviously. But you see the film, and there is a similarity. And Bradman famously practiced with a stump and a golf ball, didn't he? That kind of idea of, you know, that obsessive, relentless practice that a lot of great sportsmen sort of have. And I think Smith did some kind of thing with a ball on a string in his garage or something like that. You know, so he's got a similar. It's similar powers of application and concentration, isn't it?
You know? Well, and aren't those words that you and I have been using for the past 40 years with youngsters, and ultimately it still comes down to that, whatever format, however long, whatever colour ball and all the rest of it. But is Smith a South Sea bubble? Is he a Dutch tulip? Is he a dot-com? Is it going to burst?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I think he is actually the genuine article. Yep. I mean, I think he is one of the greats of modern time.
Yeah, I think he's got the potential to go on and break lots of batting records.
Yes.
Assuming he retains his fitness, I think there's no reason looking at how he plays.
What's his record like in the subcontinent? Off the top of our heads.
Without going to the computer.
One senses something that he's got to master, playing spin out there, maybe. But
Interestingly, just to go back to Root for a moment and back to what we were talking about in that first half hour, it's interesting to me that if you were looking at Smith, Williamson, Coley and Root, probably as the leading four test batsmen. Coley and Root perform in all three formats consistently,
yes.
Do
yeah.
they not?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And, I mean, Coley's just been taking hundreds off South Africa in all formats for fun. He is a good player, and he's got that bit of fire as well. The reason I wanted just to go back to Joe Root, though, was that Jofra Archer has played, what, half a dozen games for Sussex? Maybe a full season, I'm really not sure. Is clearly a prospect, whether or not he does go on to play Test cricket for England, as is his stated aim. Jofra Archer gets an £800,000 contract at the IPL on the strength of half a dozen games for Sussex, and Joe Root can't get a gig. What's that all about?
Well, that auction didn't really make much sense to me. Chris Gayle only got bid for in the final, I think on the third auction. Why on earth nobody would take Joe Root on? When you watch the innings when he accompanied Jason Roy, and he was at the other end of Jason Roy's innings, and he just plugged away, and it was a brilliant innings, and it went completely unnoticed, maybe quite rightly because of what was going on at the other end. But you're quite right, Joe Root can play every single format. He has no real, well, no technical weaknesses in able to be able to play any of those formats. Why on earth nobody would bid for him, and they start bidding for this guy Jofra Archer, who I have to be honest, I'd never heard of. You know, for £800,000. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I agree. I'm baffling. But, I mean, I've no idea what kind of machinations go on behind the scenes with these things.
Probably not better get into those murky waters, Jim, as far as the IPL is concerned.
I mean, maybe they were looking at him, as you said. I think there is a real danger of burnout with Root. He's captain at a relatively young age. As you say, playing all three formats, he's in the middle a lot.
He was asked to rest one of the parts of the tour, and I think that from what I read, he wasn't keen to actually.
No.
He's one of those guys that just wants to be playing.
Well, he's a huge enthusiast.
Yeah.
I mean, he's great. He's like a terrier, you know. But you've got to have a rest, haven't you? So in a way, it's probably no bad. If it means he's going to have a period of time where he can just put his feet up for a bit and recharge the batteries, it's probably no bad thing.
I think it may be a blessing in disguise. Spend a bit of time with the baby as well and just get away from it, which is something that Cook is clearly very, very good at. Do we think Alistair Cook is going to be opening the innings for England on the 24th of May?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so as well. Different conditions, it suits him, doesn't it? I mean, it's English conditions. I think he'll be opening the batting. Who have we got to replace him at
that
stage?
That would be my point, is that, to be honest, nobody has emerged who is ready to kind of take that mantle on. I mean, to be fair to Stoneman, he came into the test side, well, again, aged about 30-ish, or is he a little bit older even than that? I don't know. With a first-class average of something over 35, but not much more, you know, that isn't really, you know, you're at that age, you're not going to improve that average, I don't think, that much. And he did about as well as you could have expected him to do, I think. I mean, I think he comes out of it with a little bit of credit, actually.
Let me ask the question then, having asked it about Alistair Cook, will Stuart Broad be opening the bowling for England in the first test?
Well, I think that's perhaps slightly, maybe not quite as certain as Cook. I would suggest, given how the selectors for England have chosen squads in the past, I can't see them not picking Broad. On his day, he's still a brilliant bowler. Unfortunately, as we saw in Australia, apart from Milan, nobody really fired. I think in English conditions again, same with Anderson, is that they're at the back end of their careers, but the conditions will suit them. It'll probably be cloudy, overcast, be playing on slightly green wickets.
Well, when it swung with that pink ball, Anderson showed what he can still do. But again, I would say in the same way as we were talking about the batsman, the absence of our nightclub fighty man told on the bowlers, because suddenly there was extra pressure on Anderson and Broad. that, you know, they're bound to kind of struggle with over the, you know, they're no spring chickens.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, as well? You're quite right. When you look at the average age of the frontline Australian bowlers, and, you know, they're born in the sort of 90s, and then you look at the Anderson and Broad, and they're born in the 80s, then, you know, it tells you another story as to perhaps why they weren't performing as well, because they've been around the block. They're getting older.
What do you think of Curran? I thought Curran was has been a bright spot, really, in the he's not a kind of pace bowler, but
I think he put his hand up more than once, and might be a bit unlucky to be left out for New Zealand conditions. On the other hand, you've got small grounds, haven't you? Shall we look ahead to New Zealand by way of you guys who have to go to work won't have seen any of the under 19 World Cup, but I was, very unusually for me, having a bit of trouble sleeping with this blooming fluey cold last month, so I did stay up and watch quite a bit of it, and it was extraordinary to see this Lloyd Pope, with an even longer mane of ginger hair than Ryan Sidebottom in his pomp. I fell asleep, I think, when England in the quarter-final were chasing 127 to win, and they just lost a couple of wickets at about 50 for 2, and I dozed off, and when I woke up it was all over. The boys taken 8 for 36, and England are all out for 96 in a World Cup quarter-final. And then, more worryingly to me, the under-19 captain was disciplined.
Yeah, I saw that. I'd read about that. He was, and they weren't particularly specific, were they, about what it was. They said it was a disciplinary issue, and he was left out of that final game, which was slightly worrying, given the context of everything else that's been going on in English cricket. But
anyway, India cleaned up in the under-19 World Cup, and the let's not forget the Big Bash, because of course Australia have sent their test team off to South Africa, and only David Warner, with his failure of an Ashes series, we got on top of Warner, 441 runs at 63, that's how much we actually got on top of David Warner, and there he is at home leading this side, which has otherwise been picked completely from the Big Bash, people like Chris Lynn and this Darcy Short, who looks as if he may be a power in all forms of the game. So the Big Bash clearly is thought of as well as the IPL these days, and the women's competition too, which India doesn't have. And noticeable that the Sydney Sixers romped the women's Big Bash, and why wouldn't you when you've got Elise Perry as captain and Alyssa Healy on your side, and our England World Cup stars were a bit featureless in the Big Bash, has to be said. Okay, New Zealand and T20s we've had, and now more one-day internationals on these small rugby grounds to a degree. And then what intrigues me most about it, let's not put our prophets hats on, but is a day-night test match on the rugby ground at Eden Park going to be the occasion when T20 meets test cricket? It's happened to a degree already when Graham Thorpe got 200 in no time, and Nathan Astle got his 222 in a ridiculously low number of balls, and New Zealand nearly chased 5,500.
Yes. Well, this Guptill blocks it for six, doesn't he? It's frightening. They have got some hitters.
And the day-night thing with the pink ball and the short boundaries, and
well, I guess they've got to try and put a bit of life, let's say, into test cricket. You know, when you look at some of the test matches round the world, the crowds aren't particularly huge at some of these games. So it's a good way of trying to inject something into it. And from my personal point of view, anything that keeps test cricket alive is good. At the moment, it's under a lot of pressure from T20. I think we mentioned earlier on, Josh Butler made the point that he believes at some point in the future that we will only play T20 cricket.
Well,
which
I'm sure
is terrible.
I really fear that's where it's all heading.
I mean, Trevor, we also mentioned earlier off air about the fact Trevor Bayliss has said that he would like to see international T20 scrapped and only actually played in the year of a run up to a World Cup T20, which personally I think is something which would probably benefit cricket, because it's so saturated now with these T20s, and you see, you know, the one day internationals you have 5 1-day internationals, then you have a couple of T20s. Yeah. It does seem a relentless sort.
Yes,
of
I mean, I'm sure we've talked about this before. I'm not a fan of the format. I do like going to the odd T20 game. My daughter loves it. It's going out to Lords, and you know, it's a fun evening. And clearly, anything that's got lots of people watching cricket and getting interested in it is not a bad thing. But it's similar to the sort of the arguments you used to have with people over sort of Harry Potter and getting kids reading. You know, that's good, provided they go on to read. They're not still reading Harry Potter when they're in their, you know, 30s and 40s. And, you know, the idea, I think, that sort of... it's probably an inappropriate analogy, but the sort of T20 would be a sort of gateway drug for young people to move towards the kind of the hard stuff. I'm not sure that's really been borne out. No. I'm not sure that is the case. And I think the problem with it is, as a format, is that it reduces that the kind of complexity of what cricket is. It's that balance of attack and defence with bat and ball. T20 game is largely defence with the ball, attack with the bat, isn't it? And that's fun, but it's like eating candy floss. It's sort of, you know, it kind of, you know, it's sweet and light, but there's nothing there really. And it is a worry that people are only getting to know that form of cricket.
I wonder whether with day night test cricket that people who've watched, have gone to a T20 match of an evening and watched the
razzmatazz and liked the experience,
whether they would go to a day-night test match and actually feel the same about the cricket. Because whenever I've been to a lot of cricket matches, obviously, like we all have, and certainly in a test match, a normal test match cricket, when you're there for the day, in many ways, it's almost like the cricket goes on as a sort of... behind you almost, and everybody, it's an odd thing because I'm a cricket lover, but and as are all the other people in the ground. But it's almost like cricket's incidental to the
it's
day's
part,
entertainment.
It's part of an experience,
yeah,
isn't
exactly.
It?
And I wonder whether day night cricket changes that dynamic slightly.
It might well do. I'd be interested to go. I mean, I think it would certainly work here very well. And talking about the small ground and that, you know, New Zealand, if it swings and you've got the people trying to hit the ball for six, then you might have a really good entertaining combination of those two things. I mean, that's the crucial thing. It's the balance between bat and ball, isn't it, that the game is kind of really, you know, rooted in.
Well, I'm looking forward for one anyway to this day-night match at Eden Park, and it might just spark off something totally revolutionary. Let's hope so. And I suppose the other thing about New Zealand, apart from the slightly cooler climate and the slightly more anglicised conditions, is that test players are going to have the chance to play on the Hagley Oval at Christchurch and at Hamilton, much more like club grounds. So that's probably something different and something very welcome for them. Now, as the clock ticks on, England's schedule for the coming season. Two against Pakistan, the opener at Lords, one at Headingley, and then, well, you never quite know what you're going to get, do you, with Pakistan?
You absolutely don't, no. Completely unpredictable.
But the lad Hassan Ali, who was such a success, Urdu speaker only, and translator in interviews and all. So, you know, to a degree, probably a bit of culture shock and a bit of fish out of water. But my goodness me, he delivered in the in the World Cup, didn't he? And you know, the left arm lad who has been rehabilitated. Well, he's a fine bowler.
Yes, he is a good bowler. Yeah.
So they are a bit of an unknown quantity, but it's early season, anything can happen. And then why are we playing five more one-day internationals against Australia in high summer?
The schedulers, you just have to ask yourself, considering we've just come off the back of a long Ashes tour with ODIs and T20s, and all of a sudden Australia are shoehorned in at the start of the season yet again.
It's money, isn't it? It's gate receipts, and I quite agree.
You know, in the old days, we'd have one main test series, we might have a second, much shorter appearance by another side. You'd have a small amount of ODIs, and everybody wanted all those games were sold out. Everybody wanted to go to
I totally agree with that. And I'll tell you what else has happened with the way modern cricket and tours work, and that actually adds further fuel to this argument. I'm not sure that 2020 really is bringing the crowds back to cricket in a profound way, and that is that when you had proper tours, as I would call them in the past, the counties played the tourists, yeah. And you got to see the stars at your local county ground. You know, you could go. You know, you had that fantastic season opener at Arundel, which was just dripped. You know, the tradition and spirit of cricket. And you know, I remember going years and years and years ago when I was a student, going to see Surrey play the Aussies with Lillian Team, and Surrey won, and it was a cracking game of cricket. And I sat and watched all 3 days.
And the traditional long tour opener at Worcester, where Bradman always got a double hundred before and after the war. Yeah. And 7/21 in a day by Australia in 1948 at Southend. Absolutely extraordinary. Well, then the main event is T20s, ODIs and five tests against India. And I guess that's going to be quite a titanic series.
Yes, that's mouth-watering, isn't it, really? And you know, we've got a real and on home turf, we've got a real chance of putting one over on them. I think it'll be a good, really good series.
By the same token, I suspect that Virat Kohli will be wanting to he's already gone halfway to making amends for that first abysmal series that he suffered here, but I wouldn't bet against him making a stack of runs, especially later in the season if it's a decent summer.
Yes,
and
if things have been hot and dry,
dried up a bit. Well, no doubt that will be something to which we will return. We haven't really got time to talk about county cricket, but we touched on it earlier that with Hales and Rashid withdrawing their services and ever more shoehorning into April and September, it's almost an also-ran, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's played in freezing cold conditions now, so why would anyone want to turn out in April and September when it all happens?
Well, it's going to get even harder once the new T20 tournament comes in a couple of years' time, this city-based T20 tournament, which, again, it does make you wonder whether the ECB are using the 2019 World Cup in England almost as a sort of way of publicising their own T20 tournament. I know it's a different format, but it's almost as though it was a sort of precursor to this next big tournament they want to release. And if it's to the detriment of test and county cricket, it would be a shame, but it does feel like that's the way things are going.
Absolutely agree.
Well, there we are, the relentless march of what some would call progress, not necessarily everybody. You know, our county championship stalwarts standing in the way of progress. It's an interesting debate, isn't it? We've got 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm delighted to report that in the Cricketer magazine's 2018 guide to the top 100 schools in England, Reigate Grammar School has taken its place alongside Sevenoaks.
Oh, good.
So we're all there, Jim.
Good.
And I think that's well deserved. The new young master in charge at the grammar school, James Leck, who is an old Cateramian, incidentally, and his father lives in Jersey, so there are real connections there.
Great.
And he's a very impressive young man, Tim, and I think we'll take them places. Well, there we are. We've got a Women's World Cup to live up to, and I suppose we'll also be looking forward to the club season in our next show, which is in April, Tim?
April the 5th, that's right. We're going to be doing the first Thursday of every month during the summer.
And Jim, you'll come back and see us, won't you?
Oh, I hope so, yeah.
Commitments permitting. Just as there's time, allow me to mention the fact that the informal T20 competition, which has been indulged in by a few Surrey villages, is being formalised in the new season as the Surrey Slam. I don't know much about it, but I know that South Nutfield are going to be involved in it, so when South Nutfield are here with us, we'll find out.
Sounds like a wrestling move.
But I looked up something online about this today, and it's going to be 4 separate regionalised competitions.
Crikey.
It's either going to be 26 ball overs or 15 8 ball overs. It'll be 120 ball innings. Regionalised competition will have its own take on the format. Use of pink balls, so it sounds good. So I think hopefully that will help rejuvenate a bit of cricket, hopefully in Surrey at local level.
So that's going to be the Surrey Slam. Jim Grant from Sevenoaks School, Bon Viveur, all sorts of other things. It's been a delight to have you with us as a pundit as usual.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tim, that's absolutely flown by.
Yeah, brilliant. Two great guests tonight.
Thank you for your input. Let's hit another button. You've been listening to On the Front Foot on Suzy 103.4 with me, David Jay, and Tim Bowling, our guests tonight, to whom many thanks. Jim Grant in the last hour, mulling over matters down under this winter, and before that, Howard Cohen from the Association of Cricket Officials, telling us about his educational roles and his long career as a coach and an umpire. We'll be back, as Tim said, on the 5th of April, so we'll see you then. For now, all that remains for me to do is, from all of us here on the Front Foot, to wish you a very good night.